world is undergoing some massive changes on the spiritual and technological level, so how can we make sense of it all? Well, today I've got a guest who's been an expert in these fields since the 1960s. He's got one of the very first PhDs in artificial intelligence, and he was studying Rosicrucianism with Project Blue Book's very own J. Allen Hynek. Today we're joined by Dr. Jacques Vallée. This show is going to be great. We're going to talk about the origins of ARPANET, the internet, its goals for evolving humanity into the digital matrix. I don't know. We're going to find out. We'll talk about the occult processes and practices for manifesting UFOs, Jack Parsons, sex magic rituals, Rosicrucian interests, and Dr. Jacques Vallée's friendship with Dr. J. Allen Hynek, the power and symbolism of the desert and the spiritual component of the phenomenon, Collins Elite, Satan, all kinds of stuff. In fact, this is such a special interview. I wore full-on sleeves with a button-up shirt. Oh, it's crazy. And if you're listening to this podcast, let me tell you something. The video version of my show has been high drama for many years. As you know, I've been torched off of everything. YouTube, Vimeo, everything, you name it. And my third YouTube channel got torched, and I'm sort of resuming uploading to my second one. It's a tragedy. It's a whole mess. But here's the short version. Right now, the way I have the system running, if you want the video version of the show, if you sign up at tier 2 on my Patreon or VIP section, you get it instantly when I release all the shows, okay? Ad-free, all that stuff. But if you want to watch the video version, I host it to my Rumble channel, which is at Occult Symbolism. You can find links for all my links all the time at allmylinks.com/IsaacW. But you can find the video version of my show at Rumble completely, all of them, because like, they don't censor, which is great. I'm also going to maintain my other YouTube channel and try to grow that one again. I don't even remember the name of it, to be honest, but it's on the allmylinks.com/IsaacW. Link tree. You can find that. And usually what I do is for my supporters, I'll give it to them ad-free instantaneously, and then the free feed folks, they get it about a month late. Now, because this is a very special interview, I'm going to release it on quickly, much quicker than a month. I'll wait a few days so the supporters can get first access to it. But I'm going to have it on there, so be sure to check it out if you want the video version, because I've got the video version of me talking to him and all that stuff, of course, right? And also, another quick plug, I'm going to unpack this entire interview on Breaking Social Norms. That's my other podcast I do with my wife, Josie. She's the normie, I'm the conspiracy guy, and I kind of break things down, and she's great because she can give the perspective of someone who doesn't follow any of this stuff, and she can kind of say, hey, pump the brakes, what are you talking about, blah, 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 bada bing. And that's a perfect venue for me to unpack and decode all of the things that we're talking about. And there's going to be something that he references in here about an experience he writes about in his new book. And much like a lot of his responses, he's like one of those highly intelligent people, right? And I'm trying to make sense of it. And I'm like, what is the lesson here? What is he trying to tell me? And I re-listened to the whole interview, took a bunch of notes, and I'm going to explain it to Josie. But there's something that I found, and it's kind of a bit of a eureka moment, I believe. I still got to firm up some of my research, but I think I found something that connects what he's saying into the world of Jack Parsons and James Shelby Downard. It's pretty crazy. We'll see. But anyways, I'm going to unpack it on Breaking Social Norms, so make sure you subscribe to that podcast as well, because that'll be in the next week. So there you go. All kinds of links I'll put in the show notes, as well as I'm going to reference my interview with Paula Harris. She wrote a book called Trinity with Dr. Jacques Vallée about the Trinity crash that happened in 1945 after the atomic bomb. That was actually the first UFO crash that started the big flap of the 40s. But I interviewed her a couple years ago. So I'll put that link in the show notes, as well as Professor Dana Pasalka. I interviewed her two different times for each of her books, so you can check that out. And I'll put a link to Dr. Jacques Vallée's new book, Forbidden Science 6, in the show notes with all kinds of stuff. So you've got a lot of places you can go from here, okay? So take a listen to the interview, and I'll hit you on the outro. Today we're joined by a very special guest that has shaped the world we live in more than anyone that I've interviewed. There's two people in this world that I want to talk to because they understand how the world of the esoteric fits into spirituality and non-human entities, aka the phenomenon. One of those people is here today with us, So get ready to get your cap peeled back by Dr. Jacques Vallée. He was one of the pioneers in creating the internet with his work on ARPANET, as well as being one of the first to create a hypothesis of UFOs being a non-physical phenomenon, which ties into the focus of my research with the occult and the esoteric, which our guest knows a lot about as well. Dr. Jacques Vallée, he is a computer scientist, astronomer, venture capitalist, author of fiction and nonfiction, as well as a ufologist. In fact, he's the godfather of all ufologists, and he's here today to shed light on what's going on with the UFO phenomenon. And my plan is to create a mapping of questions that parallels Dr. Vallée's perspective when it comes to technology fusing itself into our human evolution and how it may fit into a spirituality. If there's one man who understands how all the pieces fit together, it's today's very special guest. So without further ado, welcome to the Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture Podcast, Dr. Jacques Vallée.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, and I look forward to your questions.
Yeah, this is, I got your latest book, Forbidden Science 6, Scattered Castles, the Journals of Jacques Vallée, 2010 to 2019, and it's a fascinating read. I read this thing and took notes on it in 2 days, read it cover to cover, and it was fascinating because I've been following the phenomenon and all of the sort of, you know, revelations, misinformation, disinformation, whatever you want to call it, all of the elements coming to light about the phenomenon over the years. And it's interesting to watch how you were working it behind the scenes with all the real players involved over those years. And, you know, and thank you for sharing your personal diary. There was some real personal experiences in there, like the loss of your wife and recurring dreams about her and your love of San Francisco, friends that have come and gone. You know, it's not all entirely just UFO talk, right? But that's primarily what I want to talk to you about because it's such an important question. And you're a guy who's been on the case for so many years. And I want to tell you, Dr. Vallée, you may not know this, but I've interviewed Professor Diana Pasalka twice and Paula Harris. So it's quite an honor to get some time with you. And I'd like to start out, if I may, back where it kind of all began with the ARPANET, the predecessor project to the internet. And in Professor Pasalka's book, Encounters, she said, years ago, before the internet, Jacques Vallée warned that the use of new technologies advertised as products would feed off human behavior. And I also read your book, The Heart of the Internet, which, you know, discusses the ARPANET and how Stanford's AI lab was preparing the masses for what was described as a new world. And the experiment saw, you know, in my perspective, AI and the ARPANET as a vision of a great equalizer to allow information, which is power, to everyone, not just the elites. And in the book, my takeaway was that the ARPANET, the internet, was a bit of a social revolution. And I want to talk to you about first how the internet has evolved. Is this meeting the original vision of what you worked on, or do you feel like things have been hijacked, maybe taken off course through things like social media? And more importantly, what does the future look like with the internet? Will this play a role in evolving mankind into something else, like a digital consciousness species?
So I actually became interested in science very, very early. As a kid growing up, I was fascinated with, you know, very early robotics and of course, astronomy. I built my first couple of telescopes and so on. And when I was 15, I saw an object in the sky, you know, with two witnesses, and that precipitated my interest in UFOs. And that's really, you know, where I started. Many of my colleagues in science who have not had, you know, a personal experience are struggling now to, they realize there is something going on. You know, of course, a lot of it is on the internet, but it's also outside of the internet, and they have trouble, reconciling it with what they know in science. I was precipitated into it by the sighting I had, which I I didn't forget it, but at the time there was nothing else that would fit. And I realized the importance of it later, a few years later, when I worked at Paris Observatory. So I'm answering your question, but I'm going back to these early days, because at Paris Observatory is when I was first exposed to computers. I had been interested in computers and took some of the earliest computing courses in France. We're talking about the early 60s, you know, 1962, 63. By that time I was at Paris Observatory, we were tracking artificial satellites, you know, the first satellites like Echo and those other constellations. And we, of course, were computing the orbits as we were observing by night and computing the orbits by day. And that's the time when I realized that not only did I have that experience with other witnesses of seeing a UFO, but quite a few astronomers had, but they were not talking about it, and quite a few scientists. And I started extending relationships that became very important later on, including a relationship with people in astrophysics in France who knew Dr. Hynek. So I started establishing a link with Dr. Hynek and became convinced that if I wanted to do serious work with computer science, I really had to come to the US. And I was offered a position at the University of Texas that had, you know, the latest computers. But I was technically an astronomer. At that point, that's when I really became interested in extending. You know, the more we, every time we tried to do something in research at that point, it worked. You know, how often does that happen, you know, in research? Everything worked. I mean, we started extending a network to get reports on, I built a catalog of European cases and South American cases. And I confronted that with the files of the Air Force when I met with Dr. Hynek, who had a complete record of the Air Force files.
You talking about the Project Blue Book? Not
classified, by the way. I mean, contrary to what everybody thinks and still says, they were not classified. And I had access to them, even though at that point I was not even an American citizen. And I rebuilt the catalog of the Air Force files under a small Air Force contract that Dr. Hynek got through the university. And then we started looking for patterns. And that's when things really blossomed, because once you excluded all the errors, and people are still saying today, you know, most of those cases can be explained. That's true. That's always been true. We've always known that. This is not news, guys. You know, this is not news. We knew back then that 80% of it was all, you know, honest people who had observed something they had never seen before, a satellite, a meteor, you know, a bolide, and reported it as something unusual. And that still happens today. And 80% of that is explained. We're not talking about that. You know, we're talking about the 10% or 5% of it, which is really well-documented, complete, 12 witnesses within an hour. We've interviewed all of them. We know where it happened. We've gone there, and we've got the stuff, and we're taking the stuff to the lab. That's what we're talking about, okay? We're not talking about the rumors. We're not talking about vague, lights on satellite pictures. You know, that may be interesting later on if we need to go back to some specific cases. But that's not where the priority should be, okay? And I think scientists now get it, okay? The press doesn't get it. The media don't get it. They're still distracted by anything that comes along, and that's wrong. So when I moved after several positions in astronomy and so on, and I got my PhD in artificial intelligence at Northwestern in 1967. Which is another area where the public is completely uninformed that, AI didn't start last week. People in the 40s were thinking and writing about artificial intelligence because you needed AI behind robots, and industry needed robots. And there were robots now coming into car companies, into GM, and those robots had to be driven by programs, and those programs had to have some form of primitive intelligence. At the time, there were very few PhDs, earned for AI. I think mine was number four. It Wow. was for an AI system that took English language questions about the astrophysics catalog of all the bright stars in the sky and gave you an answer, essentially an instant answer on fairly complex astrophysics questions. That saved 2 days of an astronomer, writing a program, running the program, getting the answers, and verifying the answers. The program could answer an English question instantly with the numerical data that you needed. It would not engage you in conversation like ChatGPT and that kind of program.
Okay. But would you say that ChatGPT is just the further evolved form of what you had been studying and working on back then, right?
So between what I did and ChatGPT, there were two generations, there were two revolutions of AI, if you want, okay? But mine was one of the first systems demonstrating that you could use English language. You didn't have to write a program to get a quantifiable answer in science. Okay, there was only one program that was at Stanford University, program called Dendrol, that deciphered complex situations for molecules, and mine was for astrophysics. So that's where that particular generation, started. After that, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, artificial intelligence got into industry. And that's why people didn't notice it, because it's in their car. The car changes the mix of the fuel it uses based on the way the climate conditions are and so on. It changes certainly watches the direction and the stability of the car, adjusted your seat, will detect if you fall asleep, will wake you up if you fall asleep. So a modern car does that. Well, that was introduced in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and so on. And now it's coming into, you know, the car you see at the, you know, at the corner. But that generation of AI is under the hood, and you can't open the hood anymore. You know, if you're smart, you let the AI do the work. So the people they've taken it for granted that the car reacted to road conditions and so on, and they don't really know how it happens. And that's fine. What's happening now is something that's in the face of the public, answering questions in English and engaging in dialogue in English. That, of course, opens up a whole different phase of our life with our environment, with, you know, things we buy, things we see on TV, things we get for our kids, and also, of course, in medicine. You know, if your doctor tells you that you have a certain condition, you can go to ChatGPT and find out a lot of things about what is the current state of the art, the current state of medicine about that particular condition, and why your doctor is recommending a certain treatment rather than another. So those are the things that impinge our life on our life day to day now. Mm-hmm. And that's a different, it's going to take a while for us to absorb the good things it does and the bad things it does. It does many good things. So if I was going to rewrite a book about computing, which I'm thinking of, you know, updating the book you mentioned, the older book about the history of the internet. And, you know, I worked with the internet on machine number 4 on the internet at Stanford Research Institute. So I've seen the ups and downs and the projects that failed and the projects that succeeded and so on, and the transition to the internet from the old ARPANET. Again, that's a history that people don't know. And it's always useful to go back, but I think people want to know, you know, what happens next. Don't really care about the history. and there are even people who claim that, you know, the UFOs gave us the ARPANET, and that I can testify, you know, that's not true. I saw the first machines, and we had enough trouble programming them. I can tell you that was real work. This didn't come out of the sky, you know, all ready to go.
I believe that. Well, it's interesting since you brought it up in Forbidden Science 6, your new book. I read a part where you were talking about, and I don't want to go too deep in the weeds. I've got an electronic engineering background, so I don't want to get too technical for the audience, really. But you mentioned this idea about associative computing, where a computer language will use this association sort of technique. And when I'm reading that, I'm thinking of how this fits into the phenomenon, right? And I'm thinking, does this fit into, is this saying that there's this simulation theory, we're living in a computer? Is that saying that is kind of similar to the idea behind the phenomenon where, and I don't really know how to ask this, but my thoughts about the phenomenon are, there's this weird sort of, they call it hyperstition in some fields, but there's this weird idea that our minds, sort of like a law of attraction or occult ritual magic, our minds can in a way manifest or create this phenomenon, or you know, visions and sightings of things and orbs. Do you think that there's some kind of simulation theory that we're living in a computer of sorts that would facilitate such a thing? Or is that like way out there in science fiction land for you?
Well, there are two things there. One is that we can have the impression that we're pushing the phenomenon into displaying new things. Recently, people have been describing something that's different from the typical flying saucers of the 50s and 60s. So it changes. The question is it our perception of it that gets refined, you know, that gets better? Excuse me. Or is the phenomenon really changing in response to our perception of it? Is there a feedback loop? The other question is, a question I've started to ask myself. Am I writing these books to be read by an AI later on? You know, and there are people in England who are using my books to as a prototype for an AI discussion into the phenomenon. And at some point, I wonder what a future evolved version of ChatGPT would do with the series of Forbidden Science, which is now 6 volumes. And that maybe I'm writing these books to feed a future AI system.
Wow.
That would go through the entire length of it, because there are many, many, many details throughout this that are nowhere else. Okay. And that's an interesting thought. You know, if there is an independent form of AI that starts developing out of everything we're doing, the first thing it's going to be interested in is our confrontation with UFOs.
Right.
And parapsychology in general and so on, because that will be at the limit of what it's perceiving. So it will want to know that. I think an advanced AI, and I think there's a lot of science fiction that relates to that, but it's not specific. It's not clearly stated in science fiction, except in very few novels. wouldn't an AI system developed by humans, what would it be really interested in knowing once it knows everything we know, which, you know, we're getting close to that.
Oh, wow.
And what is next for it? It will look at the mysteries. It will look at what we don't know. So that's why, of course, scientists are interested, because we can guide it. You know, a perfect example is medicine. There are so many things where we have the data in medicine, but we don't understand what it means. We have the data because we do autopsies on people who die, but we still don't understand what we could have done to keep them alive. Okay, an AI system is the ideal companion to a doctor doing research. And as you may know, I've actually invested in companies that worked in that area, Of course, Dr. Nolan, you know, we're working closely together, and Dr. Nolan is a pioneer in this. But beyond that, what would a very evolved AI do with the UFO story, if you will, and UFO catalogs? Well, it would ask questions that would be very different from what scientists are asking now. It would ask, you know, Tell me again, when did that start? Tell me why you think that it has anything to do with outer space. I mean, that seems an obvious to us, because the most exciting thing in science today is space exploration. We see these big rockets going up. Well, you know, big rockets were invented by the Chinese 4,000 years before Christ. Okay, so this is not new science. The new science is in the computer that controls a rocket so that it keeps going instead of crashing. Okay, that's where the science is in the stability of the thing and how big you can make it. But that's a statement of failure from the point of view of physics. It's a statement of failure. It's beautiful to see a rocket go up in the sky, but it means that we have to use all this propellant, you know, essentially a big fuse, to get out of the atmosphere, which is, you know, which is not very good. It's not very good science. The good science would say, let's understand gravity, and then let's control gravity so that we can gracefully go out into space whenever we want. You know, without polluting the atmosphere and making a lot of fire and brimstone and smoke.
Right. Well, Dr. Vallée, since you brought it up, you know, my field of research is on the occult, right? Which means that which is hidden, as you surely know. And
this was occult, you know, 20 years ago.
Absolutely. You know where I'm going with it for sure. And in your book, I was surprised to see many of the names I find in my research. Aleister Crowley, Jack Parsons, even researcher Peter Lavenda, who fun fact, he's the other guy I need to talk to someday before I die, because I know he understands a lot of the occult ideas. So, You mentioned in the book you had read a couple of Peter Lavenda's works. One was The Tantric Alchemist. And you said something interesting that I want to kind of talk to you about. You said, even the basic physical experience of sex is never twice the same, nor should it be. To ritualize it, as Crowley and the OTO did, is to reduce its power. Codified into incantations and obligatory movements, its virtue is weakened. And what I want to talk to you about, because you referenced Jack Parsons in the book several times, and as you know, Jack Parsons, founder of JPL, basically invented rockets for NASA, and he also was conducting sex magic rituals known as the Babylon Working out in the Mojave Desert, which is part of your journey. In 2010, at the beginning of the book, you're out in I'm from Lancaster, PA, so we call it Lancaster, but I think people in California would call it Lancaster. But you're out in Lancaster, California there. And, you know, this is kind of the thing that I'm always interested in, is there some kind of, between Peter Lavenda's talk about the Tantric Alchemist and different theories of, you know, sex magic and occultism stuff, I'm curious what your take would be, and this is kind of a broad question, I know, but what is your take on how these occultists fit into the phenomenon? Were they just decades ahead of their time in knowing how to sort of summon these entities with all of their various rituals and such? Like how do you think the occult fits into the world of ufology?
So there is a lot of, you know, you're drawing from a lot of fascinating sources here. I used to work with at the Institute for the Future, with a man who had been a vice president at SRI and was known as one of the leading futurists in the US. And he said, if you want to look forward 10 years, which of course we were doing for companies like IBM and, you know, AT&T and so on, trying to build scenarios of how science might evolve and how engineering might change, you have to look 50 years, five times the time you want to look forward. So if you want to look forward 10 years under contract with IBM, you have to look at the last 50 years, you know, of the industry to learn the lessons, because there were many lessons that were learned and then forgotten because computers bypassed certain things. For example, you could have computers that don't use electricity. The Navy has looked at this. Of course, in the Army has looked at this, because there are some environments where you need to do computations, but you're close to explosives. And if you use electricity, there could be a spark, and if there is a spark, then the experiment is over. So you can build computers in many different ways. And in fact, computing is now going back to look at other ways of doing things, including, of course, the quantum computers. So those ideas have been there a long time ago. You know, the patent, people say the flying saucers brought us the transistor. Well, you know, I've met some of the people who worked closely with the inventors of the transistor. I didn't have the privilege to meet the three Nobel Prizes, you know, who developed the industrial transistor. But when you look at the history, it was pretty clear that they invented it. But they were actually reinventing it, because a transistor is a German patent from the 30s, 1930s.
Oh, okay.
But what could you do with it? I mean, electronics wasn't invented then, okay? And electronics was just in gestation. And so the lamps and the other ways of dealing with electric currents came in the 30s and 40s and so on, and they worked fine. You didn't need transistors, you know, at that point. Nobody thought about it, but the principle had been discovered before. You know, it didn't come out of a flying saucer. Period. Okay,
right.
People should know that. The science works like, you know, the occult. There are things that are known that we called occult simply because they are in some obscure book from, you know, a long time ago, that, you know, we should read again from time to time. Certainly astronomers do that, because we discover things now. You know, we see something bright in the sky one night that wasn't there before. Well, you may have to go back to Kepler, you know, to know. It may be one of those variable stars that is getting very bright again, that hasn't been bright for 100 years or 200 years. Okay, so all this we need to keep reasonably current, but you know, it looks weird, so people call it occult. There is nothing occult. Okay, it's just things that are occult because we're not smart enough to think of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
And so when we bump into them, we say, "Oh, it was one of those things that was hidden." If you go back, you find that there was already knowledge of that. And of course, in the right after the war, and I think we're really doing a disservice to history, especially to the history of, you know, of philosophy and the history of this country, of the U.S., when we push things under the rug. You know, take Scientology. You know, Jack Parsons was close to, of course, all those movements at the beginning. Mm-hmm. In the 40s, right after the war, there was an explosion of intellectual power and intellectual research everywhere, but especially around Los Angeles, with aircraft, with rockets. When people saw what the Germans had done, you know, with the V1 and the V2, which we had captured, and we also had the scientists. So there was a lot was discovered about where were the real frontiers of physics, mm-hmm. of physics and chemistry, and what were the questions we should ask. Of course, that's where computers came on, out of intelligence research in Great Britain, you know, out of the deciphering engines that the English scientists had built. I mean, talk about secrets, you know. That in part is what won World War II, along with other things. But if you're going to launch an invasion, you better make sure a few things are secret. And what was known about the reaction to the invasion came through the first thing that would qualify today as a logical machine, as a computer. And so there is a transition there. You know, Scientology at the beginning, people are accusing Scientology of a lot of things. And it's over the years, as soon as it was successful, successful because it was looking into real scientific problems and into real human capabilities. Mm-hmm. And it went off the rails at some point because it accumulated power, and power will always kill science. And that's what happened to Scientology in my view. But the ideas at the beginning were not bad ideas. They were ideas that were reframed in other forms. Mm-hmm. The ideas of alchemy, the idea of the golem, you know, the idea of the automaton that can behave and can, you know, the idea of Frankenstein, you know, I mean, those were seminal concepts that from which we can use. I mean, we're not going to build Frankenstein,
right?
But the, you know, I've in my career as an investor, I've invested in quite a few things that we're doing that with grafting organs, including, you know, some pretty vital organs in the body that were extraordinary science. And if in the 50s, if you had told anybody that you could do that, they would have said you read too many occult stories.
And right.
Yes, well, we, you know, we can do that, and and we can do it with robots, and we can do it with AI. One of the companies I'm most proud of having funded at the very beginning and funded all the way along is a company that does essentially operations within the body, including the brain. Inoperable tumors taken out by radiation, but not by ionizing radiation, but with hard X-rays that are not ionizing. Hmm. And that within the brain and within the lungs and within other organs in the body. This is done commonly now. We funded the company 25 years ago, right? It was just, there were only three copies of the machine in the leading hospitals in the world. Mm-hmm. And that took a long time, but you know, the company succeeded, and now there are those machines are everywhere, and they are essentially driven by AI, so that the patient, for example, can move a little bit, and the robot will adjust the rays according to the patient, so the patient doesn't need to be hospitalized. The patient doesn't need to have a steel helmet screwed into his skull for the precision of the beams, because the beams are driven by AI, which adapts to small movements of the head. How do you do that?
I don't know. How do you do that? Okay, so
this is, again, science of 20 years, 25 years ago. Uh-huh. And somebody had to make the decision to finance that company with real money when it had never been done before. Okay. That's what Silicon Valley is all about. That's what venture capital is all about. That's what venture capital should do. Mm. And I guess, that's AI. And, you know, that's the most noble form of AI.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's like part of the
life and death. Okay. I've lived through that. Many of those ideas come back from things that people were thinking about in the 40s and 50s. It manifested in the very early science fiction around Los Angeles, you know, it also came out of places like the groups at where Jack Parsons was, you know, groups that some of the people who were interested in Scientology, you know, went on to careers in science. I mean, when I was still, you know, a young student, I was interested in the Rosicrucians, and I still value, I'm not a member of anything, but one of the topics of discussion I had with Dr. Hynek was about the Rosicrucians, because he had studied, and I have all his Rosicrucian books. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a Rosicrucian by philosophy. He had studied the Rosicrucians with a different current in the Rosicrucians that he had left also, realizing that, you know, the truth is not on this plane. The truth you're looking for is on a different plane.
Was that the result of Project Blue Book, that he studied all these cases? And
I asked him, you know, why did you get into astronomy in the first place? And why, you know, when you work with astronomers, you have long conversations at night, watching the telescope and watching the instruments. Okay, you have time to talk,
yeah.
And you talk about, you know, what the telescope is doing, but you also talk about how did you decide to do this, because it's hard, you know, it takes a lot of dedication and study, and he said that he came into science contrary to many of his colleagues, not for the power of science, but to know what the frontier was, you know, the things that were unknown, not to learn the things that were known and get paid to do the same thing again, you know, like most science is repeating things that have been done before, only adapting it to new conditions. You know, the breakthrough science is the stuff that they didn't teach you, the stuff you never studied at the university. It comes out and hits you as a scientist. So you have to look at what you know, what you've learned, you know, what's your equipment intellectually, and what tools you have, and then you have to invent new tools. And that's why I'm captivated by, you know, what Dr. Nolan is doing, because he's been creating one, you know, breakthrough instrumentation method after another, and those have gone into laboratories and into hospitals through the machines that he's helped develop. And that's a true science. That's where you want to be. And Dr. Hynek said, you know, I've always been interested in astronomy because of the things we did not know about astronomy. And of course, in, at the time when he did that, it was, you know, variable stars, multiple star systems, the gravity, you know, frontiers and all of that. His PhD was about that, okay, at Yerkes Observatory. And then at in Ohio, and then close to Ohio, there was a very big Air Force base that had the UFO files, and they looked for an astronomer who was nearby, and they came to him.
Oh, wow.
But he said, you know, I'm not the greatest astronomer in the United States. You know, there are Nobel Prizes in astronomy. There are great physicists. There were a number of great people the Air Force could have gone to. Why did they come to me? And he wondered if the Air Force knew about his occult stories, you know, his occult interests in through the Rosicrucians, his interest in alchemy, you know, his interest in, of course, in the stars. And they that he suspected that may have been part of why he was hired to work on Project Sign, not Project Blue Book.
Okay.
I have his book of Project Sign with his marginal notes, you know. And that book is pretty unique because all the Project Sign documents have been destroyed. The project was classified. And I have, you know, one of the very, very few remaining copies with Dr. Hynek's annotations, you know, on every page.
Wow, and that's incredible.
Those are the things I want to preserve because it, I feel it's my responsibility to preserve it. But those go back to the 40s.
Yeah. Do you think Project Sign was the most genuine effort? Because it went from Project Sign to, I believe, Project Grudge and then Project Blue Book. But Grudge and Blue Book were, you know, there was some disinformation happening with those. Do you think Sign was the legitimate
Blue
study?
Blue Book was the result of another secret meeting.
Oh, okay.
Which was organized by the CIA, not by the Air Force. I mean, it was, you know, the Air Force put their name on the cover, but it was a CIA effort. And because the CIA was taking UFOs seriously already at the time, 1954, Battelle Memorial Institute had done a seminal study, the first one using computing and statistics and mainly based on sorting machines, which was Report 14, which initially was classified and was declassified later. And they wanted to split the research into two directions. One that would be just to watch on what people were observing. So it was public, it was not classified, that was Project Blue Book. There are a few classified sightings in Blue Book, but they were classified because of the instrument through which an anomaly was detected.
Oh.
It wasn't classified because of the UFO. And you know, there is a there is one case of in the files of somebody observing a light over Alaska at dusk. But so the ground was dark, but the sky was still, you know, in the sun. And there was an object that seemed to be flying that was going west. Nothing goes west from Alaska. I mean, you don't, because west of it is the Soviet Union. You know, it's Kamchatka Peninsula and the Soviet Union and so on. And the this woman saw this and reported it to the Air Force because she thought it was unusual. And the Air Force knew exactly what it was. It was one of the early U-2s. U-2s were classified. So they, that case, even though the Air Force knew, absolutely knew what it was, the case is still carried in the files as unidentified.
Oh,
and,
interesting.
And that's the trap, you know, when people take all these cases and they say, we're going to do, put this on in AI, you're going to put these cases in AI without knowing the real story. And if you haven't studied the files, you think it's a bona fide observation of a real, honest-to-goodness UFO that the Air Force actually investigated and decided was unidentified over Alaska, going towards the Kuril Peninsula, okay, when the Air Force knew exactly what it was. So, again, you know, AI is fine, but you should not ask ChatGPT to solve, you know, the nature of a phenomenon that is, you know, 97% explainable by normal conditions. I mean, the AI is going to spin its wheels forever dealing with the 97% of the data, which I can tell you already is perfectly normal, everyday happenings.
But it's that last
thing mysterious about them. When you go back and you talk to the people and you look at where they were and what they were looking at, and you have the weather conditions and you have everything else, which we do have, but nobody has really put it together.
Mm-hmm.
And with Mr. Bigelow, we tried to put this together in a 5-year program, and we were cut off after 2 years. And we never knew why we were cut off. And, you know, I was... the guy in charge of the you know, the initial classification and coding for the system, and that's certainly one of the mysteries that have been left by, you know, our generation is why was this cut off, and where did it go?
Mm-hmm.
So. We're in a world that's full of mysteries, and I think Jack Parsons and others were in an extraordinary world. And I go back to that world, you know, at the beginning of this, with the case in Lancaster. That it's funny. I haven't been asked a question about that. You know, there were all these things going on in the desert that my witnesses saw. And I went there several times. And they told me somebody else had seen it. So I went to see the other guy. And I describe all that in the first 20 pages of the book. People ask me the conventional questions. I mean, you're the first one who is really asking about where does this come from? How does it tie into what people have called occult or, you know, esoteric knowledge? I'm telling you, there is esoteric knowledge all over the place. And there are also things that are known in areas that we're just not looking at.
Mm-hmm.
We're just blind. But we're blind because we're you know, limited in our ability to ask questions.
Right.
The next generation of AI is not going to be limited and is going to ask some very embarrassing questions. Like, what about cattle mutilations? What was that about?
Yeah.
You know, we've done, thanks to Mr. Bigelow, not just under Bass, we didn't do a lot of it under Bass, but under the previous program and the NIDS, which went on for over 10 years, we did a lot of work on cattle mutilations. And I had looked at cases before that are in some of the early movies, you know, some of the early reports that were are still, you can still get them on the internet, about cases of cattle mutilations where I got the word out to veterinarians. This was before Mr. Bigelow got engaged in that. He was already doing his own research, but my research was independent at the time. And I was working with a few doctors who were very intrigued with that because the cattle mutilations don't make any sense medically. And they don't make any sense in terms of, you know, veterinary medicine, in terms of working with the animals, either in the range or on cattle ranches. So I got to learn a lot with the, you know, talking with the vets and in the field near the carcass of a mutilated animal. And the doctors I was working with told me what organs to select. So for the in several cases, I had the word soon enough that I could get the word to the vet, or I could actually go there and telling the vet what organs to select, you know, and put them under ice and give them to me or send it to a particular lab. And we did that. This was before Mr. Bigelow got engaged, before NIDS even.
Oh,
and
wow.
What we got, we never figured out the results. We never figured out, well, we figured out the results because, you know, money was spent doing the analysis. But we never understood why somebody would want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And there, it's not, again, then you go back to the occult, people sacrificing animals. Well, those were not sacrifices. Some of the work was extraordinarily precise work. It wasn't a bunch of kids, you know, cutting off an ear from, you know, or killing an animal. It wasn't sacrifices like, killing a goat for invoking some demon or something like this. If you want to go back to, you know, Aleister Crowley and Jack Parsons and so on, this was precision surgery. And I spoke to a veterinarian in Arkansas, and I showed him the result of the analysis that had been done by my friends, that meant that the organ had to be removed by going surgically inside the body and cutting ligaments. You had to know precisely where the ligaments were inside the body of the animal. You know, this was a cow, to remove, in this case, remove the uterus and the entire organs as a whole from cutting inside. And he said, Dr. Vallée, let me tell you something. This was not done by a veterinarian. This is not something I've been trained to do. This was done by a surgeon and not by a vet.
Wow.
And for him to admit that, you know, to me, we were at the police station. The police had done the investigation. The police definitely wanted to know who was doing this. because they were the ones that the farmers were calling. Mm-hmm. There is a belief that, oh, you know, those animals are insured. Well, they are not insured for this kind of thing. They are not insured for cattle mutilation. Okay, so the farmers were impacted financially by those things, and they were mad, and they were calling the sheriff, and the sheriff was calling the vet, and the vet didn't have an answer because the answer, there was no answer in science.
Mm-hmm.
So we've continued to, under NIDS, we continued to do this, you know, with an expert veterinarian who had written books for veterinarians and published those books. And, you know, fortunately, we had a jet at our disposal, so he could, I didn't go there, but the veterinarian and the team could get there within hours of an alert, you know, from a vet somewhere in Montana. You know, he could be there in a couple of hours, and he could see the animal in the field. We still didn't get an answer. No, mm-hmm. Why not? I mean, what's going on?
Yeah.
Who's doing this? And it's it could be done by humans. By why? You know, what's the branch of the, you know, what branch of some secret service needs to do this?
right.
Why not do it in the range where animals are roaming freely? Why do it on a property mm-hmm. of somebody? You know, they. Where the dog, the guard dog, is going to scratch the door to get into the house. You know, a cattle dog.
Oh, okay, right, yeah.
Okay, so those are the things I've had to learn all the way along. It's mm-hmm. taken me away from computer science. I can tell you.
Right.
It's put me in touch with some very interesting doctors. And some very interesting science that we're still, you know, we still don't have the answers. So UFOs, you know, the lights in the sky, that's not the only thing that's going on. There's a lot going on out there that we don't understand.
And that is because I know I told you I'd get you out of here in an hour, and we're already there. But I want to squeeze one last question in, and you can respond as short or as long as you like, because I've been dying to know this since I read Professor Dina Pasulka's Encounters book. There's a scene where she is in your library, and you say to her, you're like, hey, I highly recommend you find this book and read it. And the book in question was a book titled Satan, and it was written... It's a book that is titled Satan, and it was written by Carmelite nuns. I believe in the book she says it was from the 1800s. Do you remember this scene? Do you remember this book at all? Is this something I need to track down? Because the reason I bring it up is because in Forbidden Science 6, you talk about the Collins Elite several times, which is an interesting subject because it, to me, it pertains to this idea because as you already know, but for the audience, there's this idea that there was this inner group embedded with the government, the CIA, whatever, since the 40s that has believed everything related to the phenomenon is satanic and that we shouldn't really study it because people like Jack Parsons were summoning demons and this, that, and the other. My question, I guess another version of the question, have you ever confirmed the existence of the Collins Elite? Or do you think that there is a sort of, obviously there's like supernatural elements, but could it be to a Christian worldview of the devil? Is that somewhere in the ballpark of how the phenomenon works?
Well, we've discussed this many times. Of course, it's a topic that keeps coming up. It certainly comes up in among people who look at the future. To what extent can you there are things we can extrapolate into, even with technology, things you can extrapolate into the next few years. But I don't think you would find anybody in Silicon Valley who would put his name to a prediction about what computers will look like in 10 years.
Oh. Okay.
5 years, yeah, quantum things. But even there, you know, there are discoveries or there are patents that all of a sudden are published that nobody had seen coming, you know, in that field. So it gets reframed. But at least we can read the patent and we understand that. Something, if you gave me a patent from 10 years from now, I probably would not have the vocabulary to understand what it's talking about. You know, that's certainly true in medicine. You know, I try to read some of the papers by Gary, you know, by Gary Nolan, and the words are not in any dictionary that I know. Okay.
Right.
And so he'll explain it to me in the lab, but the frontier of the knowledge is moving very fast. And you know, if you talk to people like Gary, they'll tell you that, yes, a genome is a wonderful thing, and there are a lot of things we don't understand about the genome, but that's not the biggest mystery. Okay? The biggest mystery that everybody is puzzled with is going to be in the proteomics and in something that will be even more complex to decipher than the genome, that, you know, you almost want to fall on your knees and, you know, admire before you touch it, because it's just so complex. Wow. You know, things that, you know, affect the human body directly, but there is no gene that controls it. It's genes together forming sort of a logical machine to have an effect that will create the condition. Okay, and that's as if the genome was a, sort of a base for reprogramming nature in certain ways at a different level. And here I should stop because I'm way out of, you know, what I know. But this is where the frontier is moving, you know, in looking at the very complex logical structures. And I've encountered that in some of the companies that, you know, and when you go into the company, you go into the lab as a potential investor, and they need the money. And because they need the money, they are going to tell me the truth about what they are doing. And the truth about what they are doing is that they are working on things that where the knowledge hasn't been published yet. I mean, that there is knowledge already in the lab and in the labs of, you know, their buddies in some other company. And they talk about it company to company, but they don't understand what it means. And if they understand what it means, it's going to be a revolution someday. And you have to believe that it's going to be a revolution before you write the check.
Mm.
Okay, so the question is, you know, tell me again, you know, what it's going to do and how what we're going to have to do to get that knowledge. And that's what has fascinated me. You know, I'm obviously at the end of my career in venture capital. But the reason I can ask those questions is that I've asked those questions systematically about UFOs and about other things. And the people I talk to know that. And I think that's why we can get into those kinds of discussions. Mm-hmm. And the intelligence community, you know, as wonderful as its methods are, you know, the secret methods and everything else that they talk about, it doesn't go far enough. Mm. You know, you have to look before they can classify something. It's in a lab somewhere, you know. And that's where the cutting edge really is. And in many cases, if the method gets classified, it's going to be subterranean for 20 years before science, before it reemerges in a product we can buy. Okay. Because it's been classified all the way along. So when you talk about gravity research, when you talk about all those things, it's in that dark area. And that doesn't mean that we can't go there. And it doesn't mean that that book you mentioned in the 1800s could be talking about an experiment that somebody did, you know, in Czechoslovakia, you know, in Prague or in some place in Europe or in China, where somebody happened to observe something and that we've forgotten.
Huh.
And or somebody was thinking about the stars or was thinking about the body in a way that was unconventional. So we've brushed it aside, but maybe he had an insight we wrote a book about ancient cases of observations. There is an observation from an astronomer in the 18th century who saw a tic-tac.
Mm.
He was an astronomer in Prague. He had an observatory, you know, on the top of his roof, and he was observing, and he saw something go up from the ground, and it was, and he describes it. I mean, he didn't describe it as a tic-tac. He described it as an oval, sort of cylindrical thing. It was white. It was luminous. Of course, in those days, there was no electricity, so the sky over a big city was black, you know, at night. Okay. So he could see the stars. He could see everything. He could clearly see this, and he drew it. And we have the engraving, and I've published the engraving, okay, in my book. I got, you know, permission from the museum to publish it with, and he published the evolution of it, how it went up in the sky. He drew it, and he did a very nice drawing with the city at night and where he was with his observatory. Well, you know, this is just as valid as something we get from, you know, from the space shuttle. It's
right.
Observation. And in the 18th century, they had good telescopes, you know, and the thing was close. It was over the city.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so I think we need to be able to go back to those days. And it feeds what to restart. When we have a branch of modern science that gets stuck, how do we restart it? Well, we have to go back to where we were before. What did we miss?
Mm-hmm.
What did Einstein forget?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're not going to fuse general relativity with quantum mechanics by pushing quantum mechanics and by pushing relativity. We have to go back to the trunk of the tree. You know, where did we come from? Where were we when Einstein was a young student? What did he miss? Mm-hmm. Because he must have missed something at that point. That is a new science, that's where general relativity and quantum mechanics are one thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, it's in the past. It's not in the future. We have to go back. Where did we branch off on the wrong branch of the tree? Well, let's go back to the trunk. And that's what, of course, that's We call that esoteric and occult and all that. It's not occult. It's not esoteric. It's just science we forgot.
Right on. Yeah, that's a beautiful conclusion to come full circle to the beginning of the conversation. I'm looking at the time. I told you I'd get you out of here, so I'm going to let you get back to your day. Thank you so much for your lifetime of work in this area. Thank you for writing this book. Everyone needs to get it.
We can do it again.
I would be super honored. You got so much. I've got just countless questions beyond these. So, but thank you for your time. I appreciate it so much.
My pleasure.
Now, that was a lot. That was a lot being said there. And like I mentioned, I'm going to unpack it on Breaking Social Norms with my beautiful normie wife, Josie. So be sure to subscribe over there. And I really want to get Dr. Jacques Vallée back on because there's several questions I still have. Particularly, I wanted to dive deeper into, in Forbidden Science 6, he references Peter Lavenda several times. And I wanted to get there. We just didn't have enough time. So again, your calls to action. You can check out the links in the show notes for more with my interview with Paula Harris, Professor Diana Pasalka, number one and number two. I did two interviews with her, and the link where you can pick up Dr. Jacques Vallée's book, Forbidden Science 6. And if you're on the supporter feeds, I don't really have a way of dropping those links. You just have to sort of scroll back to when I did those interviews. Anyway, but the book's great. The Forbidden Science 6 is great. I banged it out 2 days. That's including taking notes. I've got so many more questions for Dr. Jacques Vallée about it. I'm going to unpack and discuss some of those questions I didn't get to ask on Breaking Social Norms. Link in the show notes for that as well. Go subscribe there. Okay. All right. Whew. It was a lot today. So thanks for listening. I've got some stuff I'm working on in the lab here. I'm working on that Heretic film analysis. That one's proving to be a massive analysis. I'm hoping to get that out sooner than later. And I've got a couple other sticks in the fire. Also, quick plug for my Substack. I released an article on Lady Gaga's Coachella performance. If you haven't checked that out, I'm on Substack as Illuminati Watcher. But again, find links to all my stuff at allmylinks.com/IsaacW. Okay. All right. Thanks for listening. Stay positive.